Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast, where we take a behind-the-scenes, intimate look at surgery from leaders in the field.
Welcome back to Behind the Knife. This is our final week of global surgery. I hope you've enjoyed it. And if you have not heard the first two episodes, which have Drs. Mira, Shrime, and Riviello on it, make sure you check them out. They're fantastic. After this series of global surgery, we're going to get back to some more of our content-based episodes where we'll cover topics that will be pertinent on boards, rounds, and abcite. But we took a little break and did some series on rural surgery and global surgery to just give you guys some perspective on what you can do out there in surgery. We do have a verbal confirmation of an interview with Dr. Paul Farmer, but we were unable to make this happen during our global surgery series, so we will publish that as soon as it happens. This week, I'm really excited to introduce you to Dr. James Peck, who has served on 13 missions with Doctors Without Borders. You'll get an inside look at what it takes to serve in a civil war zone. I think you guys will really enjoy this episode. An additional bonus is we're starting out with a preview of a new surgery podcast I've really come to love titled Legends of Surgery. It covers the legends of surgery and brings their contributions to light. We have no affiliation with this podcast. I just think it is a great complement to the podcast we do now, which is interviewing the soon-to-be legends of surgery. Dr. Rouse was kind enough to share part of his episode about Dr. Burkett, one of the first global surgeons who discovered a new disease and treatment for, you guessed it, Burkitt's lymphoma, and really brought the use of epidemiology to surgical diseases in global surgery. I think you will find it a fascinating episode. Listen to the rest of the Burkett podcast on Legends of Surgery to find out why Dr. Burkett wrote an international best-selling titled book, Don't Forget Fiber in Your Diet. And of course, that's fiber spelled the British way, F-I-B-R-E. We round this episode out with a resident, Dr. Jeffrey Anderson, talking about ways in which residents and medical students can get involved in global surgery. Enjoy.
Hello, listeners of Behind the Knife. I want to thank Kevin and the rest of the crew behind the show for letting me introduce my show to you. My name is Tyler Rouse, and I'm the creator, producer, and host of the podcast series Legends of Surgery, a show that tells the stories of the people and events that make up the history of modern surgery. Here's a sample of one of my recent episodes about Dr. Dennis Parsons Burkett. It was in this rural area of Africa called Lira in the Lango district of Uganda where he made his first association between geography and disease. Burkett realized that the incidence of hydrocele, a collection of fluid around the testicle, had a 30% incidence in adult males in the eastern region and only 1% in men from the western region. It was later shown by others that this was due to the distribution of a parasitic disease called filariasis, caused by a roundworm. So following his service in the bush, Burkett was appointed surgeon to Mulago Hospital in Kampala, Uganda, which is the capital, and a lecturer in surgery at Makerere College Medical School. Hope I'm saying that right. In his first years there, his work was mainly around service to the population. I did read this one nice anecdote. Apparently, limb amputations were fairly common, but there was no way to supply artificial limbs. So Burkett went to the Royal National Orthopaedic Hospital in London for 5 months, covering orthopaedic surgery and recent advances in artificial limb technology, which he brought back to Kampala and initiated the local production and fitting of simple orthopaedic devices out of scrap metal and broomsticks. During this period of service, he would meet the first patients that would lead to his great revelation. In July of 1957, he saw a 5-year-old boy with swellings in all four quadrants of the jaw. He was unsure of the diagnosis, writing, quote, "We had seen children with single tumor jaws before, but never anything like this," end quote. A few weeks later, while visiting a district hospital, he saw another boy with the same jaw pattern, commenting, quote, "A curiosity can occur once, but two cases indicated more than a curiosity," end quote. This second boy was found to also have an abdominal mass. Knowing he was on to something, Burkett did a meticulous search of the hospital records looking for children with jaw tumors. He found that these were often associated with tumors at unusual sites like orbit, kidney, liver, adrenals, abdominal, lymph nodes, and often in young children. Now, since the histology was available, Burkett reviewed this and saw that they were all composed of small round blue cells, making them all examples of a single entity. And in fact, the histology description of Burkett's lymphoma is that of single, larger, light-colored cells on a background of small, dark cells, the so-called starry night pattern. Burkett published his findings in the British Journal of Surgery in 1958 in an article called a sarcoma involving the jaws of African children, and it is available online if you have access. Although this paper was initially all but ignored, the realization that this was a lymphoma, in articles published a few years later, brought international attention. But it wasn't just the discovery that these were all the same tumor, but rather that there was a geographical distribution pattern to the phenomena. Burkitt contacted colleagues throughout Africa, distributing a questionnaire to government and mission hospitals, and even bringing in a cancer epidemiologist from Johannesburg to study this. Plotting the cases on a map, he discovered that the tumors were confined to a band across Africa running 10 degrees to the north and south of the equator, which became known as the lymphoma belt. Now, although he was a surgeon, Burkitt quickly realized that surgery was not an option for these lesions, and there was no radiation therapy facilities available in sub-Saharan Africa. In 1960, a team from Sloan Kettering in New York visited Mulago, they were in Africa to work in Nairobi, and brought the cancer drug methotrexate. They treated a boy named Israel at Burkitt's house and saw a dramatic response over a few days. In a clever, if now considered somewhat unethical maneuver, Burkitt was able to get the drugs for free. In his own words, quote, "Chemotherapy agents were obtained free of charge from the manufacturers, who were approached in an attitude of begging, clothed in the appearance of offering opportunities. In Western countries, it was difficult to assess the effect of chemotherapy, because in most patients, radiotherapy had also been used," end quote. So basically, the deal was, Burkitt would provide unadulterated guinea pig test subjects to the manufacturers to test their product in exchange for free medication. And his approach of short, high-dose treatments, sometimes only a single dose, as the patients would vanish back into the bush, still got excellent results, drawing more attention from oncologists worldwide. He also became a bit of a figure in popular media and was referred to as, quote, "the simple bush surgeon," end quote. Burkitt went to London in 1961 and gave a lecture to the surgical division at the Middlesex Hospital entitled "The Commonest Children's Cancer in Tropical Africa, a Hitherto Unrecognized Syndrome." In the audience that day was a young medical virologist named Anthony Epstein. Okay, now some of you may have already gotten ahead of me here. Epstein was stunned by Burkitt's description of the tumor having a distribution associated with temperature, altitude, and rainfall, because that implied a biological cause. Burkitt sent Epstein samples of the tumor, and along with Yvonne Barr, an Australian physician, they published "Virus Particles in Cultured Lymphoblasts from Burkitt Lymphoma." The Epstein-Barr virus had been discovered, making it the first virus shown to be associated with cancers in humans, opening the door to an entirely new field of oncology study. I hope you enjoyed that sample. If you want to hear more, please download some episodes of Legends of Surgery wherever podcasts can be found. Thanks.
All right. Welcome back to Behind the Knife. And this week we're lucky to have Dr. James Peck, and he's going to be talking to us about his experiences in international missions. Dr. James Peck is a graduate of the University of California in San Francisco Medical School. He completed a general surgery residency and vascular fellowship at LA County. He is the past president of the Pacific Coast Surgical Association, and he's an adjunct professor of surgery at OHSU. Dr. Peck, thank you for joining us on Behind the Knife.
It's my pleasure.
So, Dr. Peck, just to get started, as we're having this series of podcasts focusing in on international health, what was your initial draw to international health?
Well, my father was a general practitioner in San Diego, and he took care of orphanages at the San Diego Mission, as well as down in Tijuana. Also, I had an aunt who worked with Mother Teresa, so I had very good role models as far as, giving back.
Wow, that is... And how far into your practice was it when you went on your first international mission?
Well, I was married, in my first year of medical school. My wife had just graduated from college, and we had two children during medical school. So during my general surgery residency, I was pretty busy with four kids. And when I started practice, I didn't have time but to spend with them. I needed to get their education. It wasn't until my family had careers of their own, were educated, that I started thinking about giving back. So it's when I was older. I was in my 50s.
Oh, wow. And where was the first group or country you get to go with and do work?
So my first mission was with Doctors Without Borders, and it was during the Civil War in Liberia with Charles Taylor. and it was pretty impressive. I was hooked from there on.
Wow. And what would you say the average length of a trip is that you go on?
Well, it depends on which kind of mission you chose, but for Doctors Without Borders, the average length for a surgeon is about 2 months. It can be as short as 1 month or as long as three, but usually for surgeons, they don't go longer than that simply because you burn out. You're on 24/7. You have emergency call and you have your regular cases during the daytime. So you become pretty tired and you need to get home. For faith-based groups, they're much more like Medical Teams International. They're much more focused on elective cases. So hernias, thyroid surgery, cleft palates, plastic surgery. Those missions are usually like 2 to 4 weeks. Doctors Without Borders pays you, not a lot. They pay you $1,000 for 4 weeks, but the faith-based groups, you pay for everything. So it's kind of an expensive vacation because they have to get all your vaccinations, your visas, your plane trip, and all that kind of stuff. On the other hand, the surgery is much more straightforward. It's more elective cases and not a lot of danger or the unknown.
Right. And have you been with Doctors Without Borders any other time other than that first time?
Yeah, I've worked for them 13 times. I've done 13 different missions with them, and I've been in many places in West Africa, East Africa, Sri Lanka, India. So for me, because I was trained at LA County, which is a lot of trauma experience, it was very satisfying.
So one kind of we wanted to help address some of the practical points of going abroad on these medical missions for some of the surgeons out there that might be considering doing this themselves. And one kind of point that kind of comes up is how did your partners allow you to get 2 months off to go do these types of trips?
Well, you know, honestly, for me, I was the senior partner and I had hired everybody. So, you know, that made it a little easier. But reality is that I would make sure that I would take call for people during Christmas, Easter, all the vacation times, because I was going to be gone. And most of my partners were younger, obviously, and they had children. And I wanted them to spend time with their children. So it's a trade-off. You really do have to work at it. Doctors Without Borders is now working with hospitals. In my day, of course, most of our groups were private. But now most of the physicians are hired by hospitals or very large clinics. And it's possible to work out a plan where there's somebody going to the third world and then is replaced by someone coming back. And so the big medical systems, the Kaisers, the Providence, the Legacies in our area, you can work that out. And so you can get, for the medical people, they have to be gone for 6 months. So that's even more of a challenge, but it's very possible to do. So I think it's reasonable, it's possible, but you do have to make some sacrifices. I just spoke with a nurse that I worked with in Liberia, and she had just got back and was working in the ER at Oregon Health Science University, and she's taking every Saturday on call for the next 2 months because she was gone to St. Anne. So you have to be able to get back as well to your partners.
Great. And you kind of broke it down for us that is it mainly that there's two main kind of missions you can go on? You go on maybe the ones with like Doctors Without Borders, and then you can go on more of the faith. Is that how you would break it down?
I do. I think that's a good way of breaking it down. The Doctors Without Borders is not for everyone. It's clearly less than 50% of the people that go on a mission with Doctors Without Borders ever go on a second one. Uh-huh. It is tough. It is, but it's, you know, for somebody that's in the military, you understand the austere environments in which you're in. And you have to be a little bit of an adrenaline junkie. You like to be in dangerous areas and be able to handle it. I do think that you have to go through quite an interview process in order to become one of those. And again, it's rare that you get chosen, but once you do get chosen, and you kind of progress up to more difficult missions as you go along. The faith-based missions really need your help, and we're very grateful for anything that you can do. And if you're trying to choose a mission, you have to look at, and very carefully look at, what they're doing in that particular environment and see if your skills match that. There's a website called Operation Give Back, which is one of the American College of Surgeons, and they have literally hundreds of missions. And you can put in your pie chart of what you want to do and where you want to do it, and it's amazing. You can find a number of missions that kind of fit your skill set.
Great. So, yeah, we will put a link to that. It's Operation Give Back. Is that what the website is?
Yeah, okay. Operation Give. It's www.operationgiveback.com. But if you go to the American College of Surgeons website, you'll see it as well.
Great. Yeah, and we'll put that in our show notes so our listeners can find that. And I would just like to hear a little bit more about Doctors Without Borders and maybe like the interview process. What are they looking for, and who are they looking for?
So the main thing about Doctors Without Borders is they're looking for people that are willing to work, for surgeons at least, willing to work in Civil War. They need surgeons in those environments. And, you know, there's never any really moral clarity about Civil War because you don't know who's the good guys and who's the bad guys. You have to be totally neutral. So this is no place for Rambos or sanctimonious do-getters. You have to be a very stable and strong person. There's obviously a long application, and then there's a very extensive interview. And the interview eliminates most people. And then, in my case, you have to be interviewed by the chief of surgery in Paris. The United States Doctors Without Borders is associated with the French. We also have Japanese in our group, and you interviewed with the chief of surgery there, and he's looking for your motivation for doing it. Are you willing to get down and dirty and do the hard stuff and willing to be tired and not be at your best and work without all the technological advances and you know, not have blood sometimes when you know you need it and, you know, just not be at your best every moment, but give your best effort for every patient that's in front of you.
Great. And I know we were talking at the meeting, and you're saying that a lot of the surgery that you do at these, especially in these Civil War environments, is, you know, maybe not glamorous, but you're just taking care of patients and doing what you can for them. Could you kind of just talk through some of the more everyday routine things you're doing there, and then to the more trauma related injuries?
So basically, in that environment, you're dealing with trauma. And a lot of it is you know, gunshot wounds, stab wounds, and especially machete wounds, as well as IEDs or explosive devices that lead to mangled extremities. So the key here is not to do too much surgery, in my opinion. You don't have blood. Your patients are malnourished and anemic to begin with. They frequently have malaria. They may have HIV. And you have to have an expeditious operation, and you really can't put somebody through a long general anesthetic. Most of the surgery that I do is done under spinal anesthetic, regional anesthetics. The anesthesiologists that are from France and Germany are amazing at regional anesthetics and get a lot done that way. I think it's important to be prudent in what you do and come back another day when the patient is stabilized. And maybe you can have some blood. Maybe you can get the family to donate some blood, and then you can do a little bit more.
Right. We talk about a lot, both in the military and with the focus on training surgeons for mass casualty events, that you really have to be prudent and triaging patients appropriately, and when patients are expectant, to understand that and to triage them in that way.
Right.
I imagine you have to assess the capabilities of your clinics and little surgical suites at out these remote sites and have to make tough decisions. Is that true?
Yeah, the hardest part is the triaging. I would say, you know, you can get, like in Sri Lanka when I was there, I got 25 patients at one time. And so you end up triaging patients with bands. So you put a black band, which means that patient's dead. Now, they're still breathing, but you're not going to be able to help them. Or you could help five others, where it would take you maybe 5 hours to help that patient. It would you could do five others in that period of time that are more stable. And then you have the ones that can be done by others, like frequently I work with general practitioners in the country that I'm in, the national staff, and they can do some of the simple things, the debridements and things like that. So I have a green band for them. So I think you do have to, and the triaging is very different than the United States. You don't have respirators. You don't have intensive care units. You don't have sophisticated nursing care. And so you're not going to be able to do a Whipple there. If you've got a gunshot wound to the head of the pancreas, you're going to drain it. You're going to put in appropriate tubes. You're going to stop the bleeding. You're going to pack it if you have to, and you're going to get out and come back another day because you're not going to be able to do that big of an operation. Patients just simply will not survive it. I do think you do have to be flexible and innovative, and I think that's one of the things that they look for in the interview. You need to be able to figure out how to do stuff that you've probably never done before, but you're a surgeon, you're good at handling tissue and treating it with care, and you can figure out how to do this. So I've done, craniectomies where I've decompressed the brain because of severe head injuries. I've never done that operation here, but I've learned how to do that in order to save somebody's life. So you have to have the ability to kind of figure out a plan, and you can't be fearful because if you don't do anything, the patient's going to die, and you have to be able to move forward and do the best job you can.
Right. That's fantastic. One of the things we talk about with military surgery and deployed environments is, thankfully for our soldiers, we can do kind of damage control and get them up to higher echelons of care. But with the local population, the civilian casualties, unfortunately, there really isn't much in the way of transferring them once.
Right.
And so we have to, do surgery that will allow them to have a life back in their community. For example, even amputees have a very short lifespan in Afghanistan and different places. So do you have to take that into account, the sort of the support network that they're going to have once you're done with them?
Absolutely. And I would tell you that a lot of the patients that we care for are civilians caught in the crossfire. That's common. And yeah, you're correct. I can remember when I was in Liberia, I went to the National Hospital, which is called JFK, John F. Kennedy Hospital.
Oh, wow.
And there was the bottom floor was flooded during the monsoon. There was no roof that was over the top, and the patients had to bribe their way to get in there. And then once they got there, they had to pay for every medication. One of the advantages of Doctors Without Borders, of course, is everything is free. And we feed everybody, which is a big deal in a war zone because most of the time there isn't somebody there to feed them. So you have to be able to do that. I really do admire people that can rescue patients and when things don't go as planned. Surgery really is no different than any other profession in life. It's not really about hand-eye coordination or fine motor skills. It's really about developing a team and developing skills to manage patients.
So, sir, I was hoping that you could talk to us a little bit about, maybe some of the different ethics that comes along with operating in these regions where you may not have enough resources to go around, some of the dilemmas that you've faced in your experience.
I think the thing that probably bothers me, and I'm not talking about everybody, but bothers me most is the gender inequality. Women are treated somewhat at the same level as animals in most of Africa. And it is, in Liberia when I was there, the literacy rate was 20%, but in women it was less than 5%. In many of the places in Nigeria, women were really not treated well. And frequently I would have a patient, especially children, that had congenital abnormalities like the duodenal atresia. Mm-hmm. If it was a boy, they would let me operate on it. If it was a girl, there was no way.
Wow.
They would just let that child die. And boys are, you know, some of it is it's an agrarian society and they need strong people to work in the fields, and that's how they survive. But the gender inequality is really, really hard to take. And the whole thing about female circumcisions and young, very young women coming in with very small pelvises that are 12 and 13 years old that I have to deliver with a C-section because their pelvis is so badly ruined they'll end up with bladder vesicle fistulas, which are just, once they get that, then they're totally ostracized and they're not allowed to come back into the society. So those things really bother me. In war, of course, as you know, there's Doctors Without Borders is totally neutral. We don't take sides. So we're always getting people from the government side and from the rebel side. So when I was in Sri Lanka, I was in a area that was under martial law. It was 100% Tamil, the population, but every 100 meters there was a Sri Lankan soldier. And during the battles, which was only about 100 yards away, I would get both kinds. I would get both the rebels and the soldiers because they couldn't get the soldiers of the army to their trauma hospital fast enough to save their lives. So I would take care of both. And yet I knew some of the people, you know, on either side, I knew were murderers. And I knew they had killed innocent victims, and which they labeled as collaborators. We had 50 collaborators killed a month in Sri Lanka. So those things are hard to take. And yet, when I would see the general or the particular person that was there, you know, you can't say anything. You're going to destroy your mission if you do. Your job is to take care of everybody, and you take everybody care of everybody the same and with the same degree of conscientiousness that you would with any other patient. So I think those are the two things. I think one of the things that I hear from other surgeons is if I had this, or if I was in the United States, or if I had an, the reality is you don't have that. So just forget that. Don't even think about that, that you don't have enough blood and you don't have a respirator and you don't have good nursing care. It's just that you have to forget about and do the best you can in the environment you're in. That's a frustration as well.
So what's your advice to people who are dealing with these, you know, kind of ethical dilemmas? I mean, it's kind of a two-part question. Like, one, how internally and externally did you handle that when you were faced with those gender inequalities where somebody's telling you, no, we're going to let this child die just because she's a female? And, you know, and speaking of resources you don't have, here, if we get into these problems, we have an ethics committee. There's plenty of people that will weigh in. But over there, you're kind of your own ethics committee. So where do you go for, you know, kind of guidance on these issues?
So a lot of it is that, honestly, I feel like I'm just doing my job. I'm a surgeon. When I came to Liberia the first time, the medical team leader showed me the OR, and he told me, don't you come out. You just stay there. If any emergency comes in, I'll bring it to you. But you stay in the operating room. And, you know, I make rounds in the morning, obviously, and rounds at night. But the problem is when you face these things, you know, frequently go back to the where the international staff. So, for instance, in Liberia, there were 9 international staff, no one else from the United States, everybody else from Russia, Greece, Angola, all over the world. And it's a multicultural thing, and you try to figure it out when you're there. You try to get the team leader to maybe talk. So in Liberia, the team leader was from Angola, and she was a woman. And I would try to, and she was amazing at negotiating things, and I would get her involved with it. And I tried to work it out, because at that time, that was my first mission, and I was, you know, trying to figure it out and work it out. You know, we had people that had been, the anesthesiologist I had at that time had been on 9 previous missions. And he was very helpful in not only, you know, tropical diseases and things like that, which I hadn't been very experienced with, but in helping me figure out the how to manage these issues. Sometimes you have to wait until the husband leaves or the chief or the whoever is the big boss leaves, and then talk to the mother and see if you can go ahead and get things done. On the other hand, you never want it to end up to be a domestic violence situation, so you have to be very cautious about that. It's not easy. I mean, these are things that, honestly, when you come home, you feel like, you know, I've never done it. I haven't done enough. No matter, you realize the problem is huge, and you come home and you feel like you've made just a small impact, but at least you've made a small impact, you know, and you know, talk about you have to take baby steps first, so that's what we're trying.
Yeah, I can't even imagine. One question that comes to mind talking about these incidences is, what is the safety like? And I unfortunately have heard of you know, Doctors Without Borders hospitals, I think most recently in Afghanistan that have, or maybe it was Syria, that have been you know, targeted. But did you feel safe in these missions?
Only because I really follow the safety protocols. I really pay attention to what I'm told as far as what I do. So yeah, Doctors Without Borders lost 32 people in Kunduz, Afghanistan, and then they lost, recently they were bombed in Yemen and lost some more. They have been bombed in Syria as well. Yeah, that's a problem, and I think it's also a reason not to be in those organizations if you're not going to accept the fact that there is going to be danger. But the way I look at it is that, number one, Doctors Without Borders doesn't have guns. So one of the big symbols that you see with Doctors Without Borders is an AK-47 with a line through it. And so we have no guns. So that makes us neutral in that we're working from both sides, and we do not carry any guns. So we're not going to shoot at you. All we do is we just do the best job we can. And I thought the guy that I replaced on my very first mission said it best. He said, your mission safety and security is depending on how well you're doing. In other words, if you are helping people, if people are getting better and people are doing better, then your mission will be safe. And he had a gunshot wound to the heart, and obviously it was very close to the hospital, and he was a 16-year-old patient, and he was able to save that patient. Everybody remembered that patient. He said, you know, later on, I had other patients that I thought I could have done a better job on, but people remember that one. So you don't want to have a bad case in which something bad happens. You want to be sure that you're doing the best job you can. I think that's the best way to have safety and security, because I can guarantee you, people there are so grateful for you being there, because without you, there's nobody. And the systems, invariably, in countries in civil war, government systems have completely fallen apart. In Liberia, all of the general surgeons worked for the government, and they fled when the revolt or when the rebels were getting near the city of Monrovia. So there was nobody to care for the patients. We were the only hospital for 1.5 million people.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, you know, one of the big, you know, criticisms you hear all the time of you know, medical mission work, and particularly, you know, a surgical mission is sustainability, and maybe we're not doing enough as far as capacity building when it comes to these issues. You know, how should we be going about doing this? And is there, I guess I'm not expressing myself very clearly, but is there more that we should be doing, other things that we should be focused on, rather than, you know, just going in and doing the surgeries, and what happens when we leave that area?
Yeah, and I agree with you. I think that's one of the problems that, you know, when you're in civil war environment, it's very difficult, because if there's no general surgeons, how can you teach them? On the other hand, everybody around me was learning. The nurse anesthetist, the assistants that were there, they are much better. And since I've left, they continue to communicate with me, and they've set up their own stuff, their own clinics and things in the back countries in order to take care of patients. There's no question you can train all the staff you can. In every country, I try to train other surgeons, and I think that's really important. And in fact, the teaching is one of the things that I really think is important, although I have to tell you that I learned much more than I taught. I learned so much about myself, about the reality of the worldview. My perspective has completely changed, and I've learned so much about different diseases that I've never seen in the United States. But I have a very definite opinion about this. One is that I think you have to train non-MD people, what they call clinical officers, how to do simple operations, C-sections, hernias, exploratory laps for gunshot wounds and stab wounds. You have to teach them, and you can do that. And there's programs in Tanzania, Kenya, down in South Africa that are doing that, and they're very successful. And the reason they're successful is because the brain drain is a big deal. If you're a really, really good surgeon in Nigeria, the first thing that they ask me is, how can I get to the United States? They want to get out of the poverty, and they want to educate their children. They want their children to be better educated, and they want to leave. If you train a clinical officer, his degree is only good for that environment, and he can't leave the country. He's got to be in, and they are very focused, and they are technically very good. Now, yeah, they don't have the basic science that we have, but they can do operations, and they can do, most of the time, they're going to do good work, and they're going to have less complications as long as you can teach them. The other thing that I've really enjoyed about Doctors Without Borders is a thing called a TROP doc. A TROP doc is a postgraduate degree that you can get, for instance, in Holland, which involves 3 years, 1 year of tropical medicine, 1 year of OBGYN, and 1 year of surgery. And these people are basically perfect for field hospitals. And they really do good work. A lot of times they're young people that are very very altruistic, that want see themselves as helping the world and helping poverty. And they go from one mission to the next. The one I met recently in Sudan, she had come from Syria. She went to Sudan, and from there she went to Yemen. And she was on a two-year cycle in which she got breaks. About every 2 months she would get a break for a couple of weeks, and then she would go to another hot spot. So those are the kind of things that I think the training for those people is great for the third world.
And did you get to work with were you able to help train some of these doctors?
Yeah, I did. And I in Cameroon, it's where I got to train the clinical officers. They're amazing. They're really motivated. It's kind of like they're from that country. They really want to make that country successful. They really want their children to be educated. And so they really are motivated. They will stick in the hospital. There's no turnover times are like 10 minutes. You can barely write your note because they're so motivated to get it right and to get on with making their country a better place. So, yeah, they're amazing, and they're very smart people, just come from a very poor environment where they can't get a college education or go to medical school. For instance, in Nigeria, 50% of those people that get a medical degree in Nigeria leave the country. Most of them go to Saudi Arabia or other countries, Venezuela, where they can get paid better and have a better education for their kids. So, you know, I think that's, in my opinion, that's what we need to do in order to kind of at least stem the tide a little bit.
And, yeah, so learning about Doctors Without Borders has been really fascinating. And it sounds like a very select group of surgeons would be capable of helping out on these missions. But you've also done missions with faith-based groups and done more elective cases and probably right. in safer environments. It may have a little bit more broad appeal or maybe more practical for many of our listeners. Can you talk a little bit about those and the differences in those missions?
Yeah, it's great. I really enjoy. They're very organized. You can bring your wife, which is a huge advantage because with Doctors Without Borders, they actually don't want you bringing your wife, even if she was a nurse, because it ruins the dynamic of the team. You really don't want somebody. You don't want two people fighting for something, you know, because when things are dangerous or whatever. So when you can go on these missions with Faith Station and bring your wife, the environment is one of much more controlled type of operations. Usually the patients have already been lined up for you by the national staff. They will line up, you know, for instance, in Nigeria, I did 30 thyroids in 1 month because all of them had been waiting for me to come and do that. But I can tell you that ophthalmology surgeons that I've gone with have done 200 cataracts in the time that I was there, or cleft palates have done 5 a day. So those kind of things are really gratifying. It certainly helps. I mean, just fixing a hernia in a Nigerian society is amazingly useful. I mean, because then the patient can actually get back to work and work on his farm and control things for his family and make a living. So those are really wonderful. I think sometimes it's a little difficult because some of the groups are especially evangelical. But on the other hand, you know, I just make it clear when I go through those groups that I'm here to give my surgical skills. I'm not here to try to convert anybody. And almost invariably, that's okay with everybody. You don't have to be proselytizing, which is, I think, one of the negative things that are said about faith-based groups. On the other hand, I can tell you that the two surgeons that I have the most respect for are both in faith-based groups. One is Jim Brown, who was a military surgeon. He was in Operation Desert Storm with our chief of surgery here, Don Trumpy. He does the most amazing job in Cameroon at Mabingo Hospital. He is just absolutely committed to training African surgeons. I think he's trained well over 50 now. All of them have stayed in the country. And the other is a guy named Tim Katina, who works in Sudan in the Nuba Mountains. And he's a Catholic physician, and he's remarkable. He just works day and night and is helping his environment. And so those guys are remarkable guys because they believe that, in their opinion, God wants them there, and that's what they're supposed to be doing. And so they do a wonderful work, and I'm really impressed with their ability to hang in there. You know, I have to come home after 3 months. I really do. I'm number one, I lose a lot of weight. I am tired. I'm very tired. I probably sleep a whole week afterwards. And I don't know if I could stay there for my life. I mean, Jim Brown, I'm sure, has been there for more than 20 years after Kuwait. And I think Cantina has been there for more than 10 years. So I don't know how those guys do it. It one of the hospitals, small hospital that I was next to the Boko Haram up in Nigeria, the woman doctor there, Helen Smith, had been there for 40 years. She had operated every day, 10 cases a day for 40 years. I mean, I really respect those people.
Wow.
So we have a lot of residents listening. Do you think that, is there a role for resident involvement in global surgery? And on the other side, do you think that global surgery should be somehow incorporated into residency training?
So the answer is yes. I strongly think it should be. And it's because the volume of surgery is so overwhelming. I take a resident with me when I go to a teaching hospital in Tanzania. This is called MUHAS, Mumbili National Hospital. It's the only medical school in Tanzania. And I take a resident with me. He's a fourth-year resident, so I wouldn't take a more junior resident. You need to have somebody pretty experienced because, in general, the resident is as good as the junior staff there. And I can tell you invariably the resident after 1 month will tell me this was the best month I had in my whole residency. It's just the volume of surgery, the amount of responsibility that you have is overwhelming. It's very much like when I was at the county hospital in my training. You asked me, what was the second question about?
My second question.
Not every group takes residents. So I can tell you that Doctors Without Borders does not take residence. And the reason is that they feel that it's completely supported by private donors. So on the other hand, it's Angelo Jolene and, you know, Bono and those kind of people
right.
that support them. They take no corporation money. They take no pharmacy money. They take no government money. But they say that their donors demand that the people that work for them are of the highest quality, and they consider residents not. The Americans have fought for years with the French about this, and it's just not going to happen. I mean, we're not going to be able to do that. On the other hand, for instance, the faith-based group that I mentioned, Mabingo Hospital in Cameroon, they take residents all the time from all over the United States. I know when I was there recently, they were from Sinai, Mount Sinai Hospital in New York, and they're required in their senior year to take 6 weeks in a foreign country and do this kind of surgery, all of them. So, and they find it very, very helpful. So I agree that I think it's a good thing. I know that at my own hospital in Oregon Health Science University, we have a very strong global health program, and the department surgery chairman is very interested in doing that. And so I can tell you the residents are always wanting to go on trips with us.
Just from a practical standpoint, I'm curious, when you do a hernia repair in, say, Africa, are you guys using mesh?
Yeah, you know, at first I didn't because I was afraid that it would get infected. Mm-hmm. But in the end, these hernias are not tiny. They are not an impulse that you feel on physical exam. Every hernia that I dealt with was almost invariably gigantic. You know, where the scrotum is down to the kneecap. And so you, in general, I do use mesh. Obviously, we make a big deal about being as sterile as we possibly can with the mesh. But clearly, we use pieces of mesh and then we re-sterilize it and do use it again. A lot of the instrumentation that we use in the third world is redone. We do some laparoscopic surgery, although the technology is a problem. You know, electricity would go out 6 times a day, invariably, at whatever country. So you can't count on it. And that's why we don't do very much laparoscopic stuff. But we do use instruments over and over again, which in the United States would be disposable because they just don't have the equipment and you have to be able to use it. I do use mesh on hernias.
Well, I'll tell you that that's will be supported by some, as of right now, I think unpublished data from the military about using mesh in the hernias in austere environments.
It is safe, right?
Yeah, it seems to be okay.
Okay, sir, as we're sort of wrapping up this fantastic interview, I was wondering if you could just maybe, what piece of advice would you give to the resident right now, such as myself or Jason, that are getting close to completing residency, and we want to get involved.
Well, I think you have to realize there are significant challenges. The places that you go are miserable. There's a lot of diseases that you've never seen before, and you have to have a 24/7 safety and security sensibility. The realities is that you're dealing with extreme poverty. Poverty like you've never seen in the United States. You're talking about just incredible poverty in people. The weather is inhospitable. In most of Africa, it's extremely hot and humid. The monsoon is overwhelming, and you have to be able to kind of adapt to that. Air conditioning never works. The lighting is never as good as you expect. The food is very different. I'm sure my cholesterol is excellent when I get back because you have no dairy products, you have no meat. You rarely will get a goat or fish. And most of the time it's a vegetarian type diet. And you have to realize that the infrastructure is not what you're used to in the United States. I think one of the hardest things for people who do is to operate in an operating room which they've never operated in before. It's like a cook operating in the kitchen and trying to cook something. It isn't easy at first, and you just really have to be very disciplines in order to do that. But what I will tell you is that I found great satisfaction in being flexible and innovative. I think the children are inspiring. That's why I think you should be there, because you want to make it a better place so that these children can grow up. The people you meet, the work people you work with, not only the international staff, but the national staff, are truly heroes. They're real. And the operations, from a surgeon's point of view, are very plentiful and very rewarding.
And true to your word, you are leaving on a mission in a couple of days. Is that true? Where are you going?
Yeah, Philippines. So this is one of these faith-based ones. We're going up into the mountains. As far as I know, the only way you can get there is by canoe, so we'll see. But this is a faith-based one, so I'm going with my wife, and we'll be there for a month. Wow. It's in an area that has a lot of mosquitoes, so we'll have to take, prophylaxis for malaria, but apparently it's extremely poor, and we're looking forward to it.
Excellent. Well, good luck on that trip. That wraps up for us. I want to thank you so much for being with us today. It was a very, very interesting talk, and we'll look forward to hearing about your future trips.
Thanks. You're very kind to have me.
Today we have Jeffrey Anderson, a resident at MGH, who was a fellow with John Mira working over in Uganda, and he was a critical asset in helping us get our interviews with Dr. Mira and Dr. Riviello, and so we're really thankful to him for helping us with our global series podcast. And I really wanted to bring him on the podcast today to introduce residents to some of the opportunities that you can have as a resident in global surgery. He got to spend 2 years in Uganda, which we'll hear about, and I think he has some interesting perspectives for you guys. So, Jeff, thanks for joining us, and thanks for all your help on the previous episodes.
Absolutely. Happy to be here.
So can you tell us a little bit about how, as a resident, that you got involved in global surgery?
Sure. Well, I guess global surgery is something global health, rather, is something I've always had an interest in. I grew up overseas. My dad worked for the government and was stationed at U.S. embassies all over the world, so I kind of got an upfront view of that from an early age. When I got to residency, I was interested in seeing how I could become more involved in global surgery. It's kind of a field that's relatively new in as a kind of a formal field. And when I was looking around for how I could spend my research years, I discovered that there's a program called the Program in Global Surgery and Social Change over at Harvard Medical School, and I applied and was fortunate enough to become a part of a fantastic program there.
Now, is that only available for residents in Harvard programs?
No, we have. So the program has fellows and research assistants at kind of all levels. So we've had attendings who have completed all their training who work with us. We've had residents from all over the world, not just Harvard, not just U.S. programs, but programs from Canada and Nigeria. And we've got some coming up from a variety of other countries around the world. And then we also have medical students who take a year off of the medical school, wow, usually between their third and fourth year, to spend some time doing research with us.
And just one more time, can you tell us the name of this program again?
I'm called a Paul Farmer Global Surgery Fellow, and it's the Program in Global Surgery and Social Change. It's under Harvard Medical School and also Boston Children's Hospital.
Awesome.
Now, Jeff, can you tell us a little bit about the curriculum of the program? How long is it? Is there milestones you have to meet throughout the program, or what do you typically do throughout the years or years?
Yeah, well, it's very flexible, and it's kind of tailored towards what your skills are, what you bring to the table, and also what you want to get out of the fellowship. I had a fairly typical route through the program. I spent 2 years with the program, and the first year I got my master's in public health at Harvard, which is, on the same campus, which is very convenient. And during that first year, I also spent I got a chance to go to Uganda a couple of times. I knew that was where I was going to be spending my second year. So I got a chance to take a couple of preliminary trips just to kind of meet the people there, get an idea for what the issues were that might be interesting for doing research and how I could collaborate with researchers on the ground there in Uganda. And then my second year, I spent almost the entire year in Uganda doing research.
Wow.
Now, there is some back and forth. You get to, one of the great things about our program is you get to get involved in a whole host of different projects. There's always people who are wanting to collaborate with us. It's been a really fun, really wonderful place to work. I feel pretty lucky to have stumbled across this.
And now tell us a little bit about what you ended up deciding to research.
So I went in with some ideas in mind, but mostly kind of just open to what problems I found and what people in, what my collaborators in Uganda wanted to research. And I kind of think I would recommend that to other people who are looking to do research in this field. Go in with, I think, humility and patience are the two attributes I think that you really need for this field. Patience, because everything takes a little bit longer than you anticipate. It's not easy doing research in general, and in doing it in low resource settings is adds another layer of complexity. And then humility, because you're going to be working with some very talented and intelligent researchers already in whatever host nation you end up going to. And they're going to have unique problems, and they're going to know their culture and their system way better than you ever will. So I would encourage, you know, people who are interested in this to go in with an open mind. Don't go in with a project that is already kind of fully designed and ready to just start. It really takes some time to get to know the place that you're going to work and the people you're going to work with. And on your first couple of trips, just go and listen. I think that it's some advice I got, and it's advice that served me very well for my time there. My projects, I did a number of research projects. They ended up focusing on surgery capacity development, especially working on some of the implementation of the Lancet Commission recommendations. I think one of your previous guests, my boss, Dr. Marin, Dr. Schreim, talked about the Lancet Commission on Global Surgery. And then I also worked on surgical education, specifically in trauma curriculum development. When I met with a lot of my Ugandan colleagues, they mentioned that trauma is by far and away their number one, their number two, their number three priority. Hmm. So we worked on that.
Well, one thing you've done all this research in Uganda for a year, but from what I can tell through our email correspondence, it really wasn't hands-on operating a lot. Was that the case with your experience?
That's true. I will say that I got a chance to do research. I got a chance to do educational work, and I got a chance to do some clinical care delivery. Not much. You know, the place where the hospital that I worked as a university, as a medical school, has its own residence. And I really tried to tread as lightly as I could there, taking cases away from their residents and impacting their residents' experience in a negative way. I really just helping out where I could. And there were a number of places where I could help out. So I did participate in rounds daily and helped out with some of the workload on the floors as I could. And then when just extra hands were needed in the OR, I would help out. I would encourage people who are looking to do some clinical work overseas that, keep in mind that you're a guest there and don't do anything that you wouldn't do back in the United States or at your home institution. And try to be cognizant of the residents that are there that are also trying to learn.
Definitely. And now going into your fourth clinical year of general surgery, how are you going to be different, or what changed you? What are you going to bring back as you come in with this new experience?
Good question. I learned a tremendous amount over the last 2 years, especially my year in Uganda. I learned a lot from my Ugandan colleagues about doing more with less and about kind of being flexible and keeping a positive attitude, and even in the face of some tremendous challenges. I think the biggest thing I'll bring back, I guess, is just some perspective on what's important and on what we're doing this for.
One last question, Jeff. How's it working with the other, the residents and the foreign nationals and stuff like that? How's that go? Are they pretty accepting you coming over there and joining in and the help? And
yeah, I made a lot of good friends over there. The residents there are a lot like the residents here. And it was a lot of fun to work with them. They're fantastic surgeons and in a lot of ways more versatile than I am. I mean, they can do a trauma laparotomy with with nothing. And so I learned a lot from them, and I hope they learned a little bit from me, and made some good friendships. I made some good friendships over there.
Good.
Well, thanks, Jeff, for all the help in setting up the Global Health Series, and thanks for joining us to give us a little perspective on the opportunities that are out there for our residents.
Oh, thank you very much. It was a privilege to be on here.
Until next time, dominate the day.